Hi, Bobby Halton here for our sponsor, Unimac. Hey, Unimac wants to remind you to take care of your crew with the most complete PPE cleaning solution in the industry. With washer extractors built for maximum performance tailored to NFPA 1851 standards, simple record-keeping capabilities, and free training for your entire firehouse, it's no wonder that Unimac is called on by fire crews across the nation. Check out Unimac at unimac.com/firecrew.
Taking it to the streets is all about advancing firefighter safety and operational integrity for the fire service through provocative insights and dynamic discussions dedicated to both the art and science of firefighting and the traditions of the fire service. The focus at Taking It to the Street continues to be straightforward street-level talk with intelligent, stimulating, and provocative insights and dynamic discussion with interactive dialogue and, most importantly, listener participation. Just like around the kitchen table or in the day room over a cup of coffee at 02:30 after a good run. And now, the latest edition of Taking It to the Streets with your host, Christopher Nall.
Welcome to this edition of Buildings on Fire's Taking It to the Streets, on your street, in your city, across the country and around the world. Thanks for tuning in to our third installment on our insights on buildings of brick and joist type 3 construction, the anatomy of building construction. This is our part 3 of our 4-part series. Hopefully some of you may have had the opportunity to tune into our previous programs over the course of our summer months. We rolled out our first program in the early parts of June. And again, here we are in September, and we are just starting into our third part of our 4-part series. I'm pleased to say that, again, we'll be culminating our program, coming up with our fourth installment, which will be really a very comprehensive overview of some key items and insights. Our program is going to take place, actually our scheduled program for our part 4 culmination of our program will be on Thursday, October 21st, if you want to just mark your calendars accordingly. Again, we'll be talking about and wrapping up our conversation here as we roll into the closing commentary, but really talking about some of the challenges going forward. We've got a great lineup of a number of programs here, our Taking to the Street series, that are very familiar to you. And as we finalize those, as we move forward here the next couple of weeks, we'll be posting those and letting you know in advance on our various social media sites and pages on fireengineering.com and so forth, what we'll be covering and who those guests will be. But again, it's certainly great for you to be stopping in and listening to us either live. We are live right now. For those of you that are listening in live across the United States, our call-in number is 760, area code 760-454-8852, and again, we are live. For those of you that are listening to the downloaded version, again, I want to thank you for taking time in your schedule and, again, listening in on our discussion and commentary. For many of you that have been followers for a number of years, you, again, continue to recognize what we have attempted to do over these quite a few number of years. You know, we've rolled out a number of different series on commercial construction. Our last comprehensive series dealing with some insights on row house and row frame buildings, again, was a very comprehensive 4-part series. We've done some programs on just general construction, on our mega mansion series and so forth. And again, we've recognized that there's always the continuing need, the profound need for the job, for the American and International Fire Service to continue those efforts in understanding our built environment. Our built environment continues to challenge us in many, many ways. We talk about today's demanding and evolving fire ground, but there continues to be the evolution over time, the changes over time but the continuing indifference at times on the level and depth and degree of information that one needs to gain, the insights, the knowledge, and the skill set levels that are demanding of us to understand the buildings in such an intimate and profound way that does require of us a tremendous degree of effort. And it's a continuous effort that just doesn't end or stop with a particular, or start or end with a particular podcast or reading a particular book or a series of informational guides and so forth. It really does require a career-long effort that really does establish itself each and every day that you're on shift, when you're off shift, just watching what's going on in your communities and so forth relative to the built environment, the changes, and how that will affect, potentially influence fire ground operations. So, but again, you've heard that story before. Certainly it's nothing new that I've certainly talked about, but again, a lot of exciting things coming up. I certainly want to, again, as we get into our discussion tonight, so one of the things that we've been which has been very common to our program, is that our programs certainly are not superficial by any extreme. And for many of you that have listened in, we've typically put in a very hefty 1.5 to 2 hours worth of content, which could very well be a 2 or 3 part series unto themselves. But in this episode, we're going to focus in on just covering some building performance issues. I want to talk a little bit about the evolution and changes over time that really result from the changes from a code standpoint or the regulatory issues that have affected these buildings of Type 3 construction, and how, primarily in our current context, in our current stage and place and time here in 2021, there continues to be challenges regarding how we classify our buildings, the occupancy risks associated with the occupancy types, but more importantly, when we talk about construction systems as they relate to our building anatomy, the issues in how we classify our buildings. Excuse me with that. Again, one of the challenges is that the issues dealing with how we classify our buildings and again, the typing of them. Certainly for many of you, all you have known for many, many years or decades of time is that we classify our buildings, in this instance, our ordinary brick and Jewish constructed buildings, as Type 3 or Class 3. The other associated type of construction that has some similarities, although different relative to characteristics, is our Type 4 heavy timber construction. But what many of you may not know is that the classifications of our buildings, which also leads to the study of our buildings relative to how these buildings were conceived, designed, and built in the earliest era of their time, and era and vintage continues to be such a significantly important buildings. When many of these buildings were built in the primary era of the 1800s and certainly going into the 1900s, our buildings were classified and referred to in an entirely different context. Their classifications, their referencing in any of the documents that were available at the time, certainly the information that was coming out of the National Board of Fire Underwriters in the late 1800s and early 1900s, as our codes were initially being conceived and in the very, very early days of code promulgations, the regulations, and the laws that were coming about as a result of significant fire losses in the developing metropolitan and urban areas that, again, were just growing, starting into their growth phases, the significant conflagrations coupled with the significant loss of life to the civilian and to the fire service population, but more importantly, the significant loss of life in very high-profile fires in which hundreds of civilians lost their lives, really became the impetus for the development of certainly the initial fire prevention, life safety, and building codes that, again, we now have become very, very familiar with here in the maturing of our fire prevention initiatives and our codes and our regulations. But in the late 1800s, mid-1800s, late 1800s, there were very limited types of codes, number one, or regulations that either directed or guided may not have had the regulatory insights or laws that were established. That didn't occur until the 1800s and the early part of the 1900s, but they were very sequential in fashion, and I want to cover some of those elements here, especially when we talk about the typing of our construction systems. So many of you only know what you know relative to what you've read in any one of a number of publications that are out there. Certainly any number of the current textbooks that are on reading lists, on promotional exams, or that continue to be part of the types of books that one should have on their in their libraries to become knowledgeable and educated and to develop the skill set levels as a firefighter, certainly as you move up the ranks into the fire officer position, and then more importantly as one assumes the command roles and responsibilities in the streets. The textbooks that we have become accustomed to typically have not gone back into the level of detail. We know what we know based upon the five building types, the occupancy listings, the information that is promulgated out of NFPA 220 standard, but I want to talk a little bit about where that 220 standard came from relative to its age and its vintage and what we have always been coining and referring back to in terms of era and vintage of our buildings. It is one of the key elements of our five-star command model that we'll talk a little bit more about here tonight. But again, it's important to understand these elements here when we talk about the predictability of the buildings. And what I want to conclude our episode here, our part three series, is talking a little bit more about the predictability of collapse of these buildings, because they are inherently prone to collapse based upon a couple of key elements. It's the method and materials of construction, the manner in which these particular construction materials and the manner in which the buildings were give way to and directly correlate back to the potential for compromise and collapse in the buildings. The one thing we have to have in the forefront of our minds when we talk about brick and joist construction, type 3 construction, class 3 construction, is that they are highly prone to collapse. And then also based upon other aspects that have affected that building over the building's life cycle, and by that we mean when a building first goes up and is constructed, that's when it's born and that's when it begins its life cycle. It's not until the end of that life cycle, when the building is demolished and there's nothing left on that site, that footprint of the building is gone, that becomes the termination of the life cycle. But as long as that building is in existence and is standing and in whatever property lot, it has undergone over the course of decades of time changes. And those changes are affected certainly by environmental and weathering related impacts, just age and deterioration of the materials of construction, but also when we talk about life cycles, it's the either subtle or very distinct types of changes that have affected the building relative to its occupancy and usage over the decades and years of time or centuries of time, and how that also affects the building's predictability, and more importantly, affects the building's potential for either limited or marginal compromise, or sometimes significant catastrophic collapse considerations. But these buildings, just based upon how they were built, the methods and the materials, the manner in which the structural assemblies of the buildings coexist with the various materials of the perimeter walls, the roof systems, the compartment, the floor diaphragms, how the building exists and is constructed, part of its building anatomy, and we've talked a little bit about this in our previous episodes, and it's a continuation of that theme. How they are built also becomes a key element of how they potentially are affected by the life cycle of the building, and then certainly when we throw in the tremendous degree of potential assault on that building from fire and heat impingement, direct fire impingement, fire degradation, or heat signatures and heat degradation of the building. So there's heat, there's thermal-related conditions, there's direct flame impingement, which may cause a variety of different aspects of potential degraded conditions on the building. So a lot to be said about it, and I will get into some of these details at a very high level. So naturally, as a podcast being what it is, much of what we talk about does have a fair amount of influence by being able to look at the visual aspects of it, a visual example. So I don't want to make it overly complex, but I do want to give you some key insights here that will hopefully afford you the opportunity to seek out further information, do some additional research. I want to make reference to a number of NIOSH reports in particular that we have had the opportunity to embed in those reports through our direct involvement, being part of the technical review process, being part of the contributors to the content in the analysis and review, the actual investigation stages. There's a couple of key reports out there, especially when we make reference to collapse and compromise considerations, in which you will be able to gain both visually, the graphics that we've developed in those reports, as well as the information, the hard-written information, because there is no single source document. There is no single definitive book that's out there that will give you all the answers. There are a number of exceptionally well-written and insightful textbooks and reference books that will give you insights, but collectively, when you put them all together, not singularly, independently, but in a composition of these particular books, that will start giving you the foundation to build from, because it is a foundation. It's a continuous effort, as I talked about, and it's much more than just the fire service documents or the fire protection engineering types of books that are out there. One has to really get into other reference books that are typically architectural or engineering based. And as I'm talking to you here within the confines of my studio and actually my office setting, I'm just looking over my shoulder and looking at about 5 or 6 or 8, maybe 10 shelves worth of bookcases here that have these types of reference available that really, again, we just don't talk about them enough. For some of you that had the opportunity, so FDIC was just occurred. We were able to roll out and participate at FDIC 2021 in Indianapolis here in the month of August. We had a very robust degree of participation. It certainly wasn't what would normally be expected or typically found at FDIC in the past, but COVID certainly still has its challenges for many of us out there on the job throughout the United States or even internationally. But again, for those that were able to attend, it was, again, truly another phenomenal opportunity to have a face-to-face opportunity to listen in and participate and get into dialogue, more importantly, be able to study in the classroom type settings. But we did a program on a fire officer's guide to today's buildings on fire, and again, focusing in on some key elements there. And we did make reference to a number of these particular books and documents that are available. And I'll just make reference. One of the things we're going to talk about here in our program are some excerpts out of some previous editions. I'm actually going to talk about the 10th and 9th edition of the NFPA handbook, which originally was the Crosby, Fisk, and Forster Handbook of Fire Protection. So again, and that goes all the way back to the late 1800s, but we're going to talk about 1943 and the 1948 edition. But again, I'll just leave you with a couple of key little levels of insights here. So just take a look at Radford's Cyclopedia of Construction. And again, Radford's, R-A-D-F-O-R-D-S, Radford's Cyclopedia of Construction. Take a look at Kidder's Architects and Builders Pocket Book. Take a look at Merritt's Building Construction Handbook. Take a look at the Handbook of Building Construction by Houle and Johnson. Take a look at the Building Construction and Superintendent Series, Parts 1 and 2, again by Frank Kidder. Take a look if you have the opportunity to identify some of the original architectural graphic standards going back all the way to the early to mid-1940s. And then also another exceptional series of books that are tied right into what we're talking about here with Type 3 construction is Audell's Carpenters and Builders Guide and Audell's Masons and Builders Guide series. And these, again, get into the nuts and bolts of construction back from the late 1800s all the way up here into the current time frame. So these are the types of books that one has to be, number one, aware of, and then secondly, have the investment of time and the ability to comprehend the degree of details and the information out there, because that's where it's all at. It's getting into the dirt, not even in the weeds, but into the dirt of the details of how these buildings were constructed, and that's where much of what we derive relative to the details. I mean, again, I was fortunate enough to go to school, architectural school, and really started developing in my early days of the fire service when I was on the volunteer side, going to school, architectural school. We learned and gained some insights, but again, when we look at just looking at one particular book, whether it be a book on building construction, of which there are a number of exceptional books, or focusing in on some of the key books on the collapse of burning buildings, or on the Brannigan series, or the Ista series on building construction. I mean, there's a variety of different elements. There's some other tremendous books that are out there that relate back to, again, building construction related to the fire service, Fire Ground Size Up by Turpak, The Art of Reading Buildings, or getting into Francis Ching's books on building construction and the illustration elements and so forth, or going back, again, even to the fundamentals of construction based upon some of the insights that came out of Fire Attack 1 and Fire Attack 2 by Warren Kimball, some of the elements of Emanuel Fried's Fire Ground Commander series, and even some of the information that came out of the NFPA Attack and Extinguishment of Interior Fires by Frank Lloyd and Firefighting Tactics by Lloyd. There's a lot of textbooks and information that's out there, guys and gals, that, again, form this basis. So, again, I've sort of gone a little bit off tangent here, but that technical information is so critical and so important to understand. One of the things, again, when we talk about Type 3 construction, and I think I may have talked a little bit about that. When we talk about Type 3 construction, again, we're typically dealing with timber and wood, typically not less than 3 inches and normally greater than 8 inches plus, depending upon the manner in which the joists and the materials are being used structurally. Masonry, stone, tiled, a variety of mixed types of masonry types of materials, both unreinforced masonry as well as reinforced and unreinforced related types of brick or tile or masonry types of systems. But again, even relative to age and vintage and era, it's important to understand that, and that's why when we talk a little bit more about the code issues here, it goes back to just understanding and having appreciation of the importance of era and vintage. Era and vintage regarding the issues dealing with the building anatomy, again, is the key fundamentals of our five-star command model. We talk about building anatomy, we talk about era and vintage, occupancy risk and occupancy type, along with other occupancy profiling considerations. The third element is collapse and compromise characteristics. The fourth element is the methods and materials of construction that are all, again, based upon era and vintage. When did that building get built? What are the kinds of methods that were utilized for the construction of the buildings, the engineering, the architectural, the design, just the vernacular ways of how buildings were being built in that particular era and time, and the materials that were being utilized. Again, it goes back to those key elements, and then the fifth piece is the fire dynamics within that structure. So masonry, stone, brick, unreinforced and reinforced. Typically, our buildings were constructed of simple joints and connections, bracings, hangers, and holders. They were designed around compression versus tension. And when we refer to that, most of our buildings of engineered construction in our current modern era are more tension-based versus compression-based. And it's an important element to understand or have an appreciation of. Bearing, compression, some of the aspects of the types of bolting, rivets, wire nails, cut nails, again, even just the simple jointing of carpentry and how our buildings were being connected and how they relied on a series of elements that all revolves around the principles around physics. the fire cut, especially when we talk about the aspects of structural integrity and the potential for compromise and collapse. And again, here's a key element of why building era and vintage is so important. So if I was to ask any of you out there, why, if I had a building that was built in 1900 versus 1915 versus, let's say, 1890, why are those dates so important? So I either see a capstone, I see a cornerstone, I have some knowledge, or more importantly, again, showing up on street, I'm looking at the cornice of the building, I see a capstone, and it says, again, any one of those particular dates, 1890, or it says 1918. Or the cornerstone. Again, the date might be put in there, or certainly over the canopies if those features are still present in the buildings. Era and vintage has everything to do with how these buildings were being built in that era of time. And when we talk about the fire cut, some of you may, again, be familiar with that terminology, the fire cut or the fireman's cut. Some individuals utilize that term interchangeably. But it's really the bevel cut. So if I have the square end of a joist, a floor joist, in a particular time, and I'll give you that year in which it occurred, at a particular time, codes and regulations that were being adaptive were being developed as a result of significant urban area conflagration. So we're burning buildings down, we're killing civilians, we're killing firefighters at a very rapid, high pace. The National Board of Underwriters in particular, along with the emergence of the NFPA at that time in the late mid to late 1800s, started recognizing and identifying and improving upon construction practices to do a couple of things. Allow some continuation of building integrity, recognizing the fact that these buildings were going to eventually catch fire and eventually burn with some degree of severity, that significant property loss was expected. And that was common. It was the emerging era of the fire service, and certainly the era and time in which the availability of resources was limited, and when a building and its occupancy and the materials within that building caught fire, normally they led to very significant, challenging, and more often than not, devastating conditions that included both property loss and the loss of life. So let's fast forward here. So around 1892, some concepts were being developed by the emerging factory mutual group within the Northeast that were designing and building buildings of mill construction, heavy timber construction. We also started seeing the conflagrations affecting urbanized areas based upon a mixed use of construction. This was prior to the formalization of fire areas within the urban settings that restricted the use of wood frame construction and really started requiring that some type of fire resistiveness, primarily being brought forward from masonry and stone construction, where masonry construction became the primary construction material and methods within the urban and dense areas that had regulatory requirements to help minimize the spread of fire from one building to another. So the origination of the beveled end cut to the floor joist, which eventually became known as the fire cut, based upon the fire services involvement, again, in the late 50s and into the 60s, that beveled end cut of the floor joist, which was initiated in 1892 and then further defined by the code recommendations in 1894. So the importance of buildings prior to the early 1890s, more often than not, would not have a beveled fire cut present to them, which would in fact affect the integrity of a masonry wall, whether it be a party wall or a bearing wall, in which that if the floor starts compromising and collapsing, that release and that movement would result in a moment within the structure and affect the wall configurations, and normally would result in some type of a wall collapse, internal or external, or a variety of both. But nonetheless, it would result in a much more catastrophic large area failure of the building. The fire cut or beveled end floor joists and roof joists, as a result of that, created a bevel cut to that end. They were pocketed into the various types of wall constructions, and once the floor ends up giving way due to deterioration or other factors due to fire within the occupancy, the floor was designed to give way, release, fail into the building, and more likely and more often than not, allow the wall to remain to, in some degree, if not a higher degree of integrity, which allowed for a minimal property loss, especially as these buildings were becoming more and more insured by the insurance companies that were developing post-Civil War era. And again, it was all about the losses, the monies, the insurance, and being able to put these buildings back on the tax rolls. So the other key element here was the institutionalization of those elements here. So it's not only the beveled end cut, but it was also the introduction of having various types of reinforcement to bearing walls and party walls, and that was done through a variety of different types of spreader plates or reinforcements that were tied back into the masonry walls. That for many of you, if we just say, hey, if you take a look at a building that was built in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and you see a diamond plate or a spreader plate or a star plate that's located on the outside, and they're positioned and oriented in some type of uniformly distributed integral. In other words, every 6 or 8 or 10 feet, one would see these particular types of configurations with the nut, some type of an appendage, the threaded rod, and some type of a plate that was typically located at the floor or roof line of where the joists were. That was, again, developed in that time frame of the 1894 era, 1900s era, when the first national building codes were being developed and then fully institutionalized in the first national building code based upon the National Board of Fire Underwriters in 1915. So a little bit of history from that standpoint, and it's important to understand. Other aspects of our buildings, wrought iron, cast iron, crucible steel, forged steel, rolled steel, Bessemer steel, these are all things that evolved over this period of time. Again, have some very distinctive elements here. If I was to ask anyone out there, you know, when was the first use of cast iron in a building, in a structural building? When did that first originate? And that was 1859, 1857, 1859. Wrought iron was introduced in 1859 and further expanded upon in terms of construction in the mid to late 1880s. And even just the use of various types of mortar mixtures, lime, sand-lime mixtures, the introduction of Portland cement in 1840, but it wasn't until the early 1900s did the replacement of sand-lime mortar mixtures in the composition of our bearing and party walls, again, unreinforced conditions, revert back to Portland cement types of grout. So although Portland cement was originated in 1824, it wasn't until the late 1800s, early 1900s, based upon the National Board of Fire Underwriters' first issuances of that National Building Code, did we start seeing those changes. So just a little bit of insights from that standpoint. Even some of the aspects of brickwork. So we've been talking about load-bearing masonry walls. Again, there is a variety of different types of things that occurred over different periods in the 1800s, going from handmade bricks to hard-pressed types of bricks that were utilizing a sand-lime-mortar mixture, all the way to, and that was, again, in the 1850s, the 1870s. A lot of things started occurring after the Civil War as a result of the Reconstruction of the South, but just the development of machine-made bricks in the late 1870s was significant, and then the utilization of Portland cement mixture in conjunction with machine-made bricks that started off in the mid to late 1880s. So just some different elements there that, again, shows you the importance of era and vintage when we talk about construction. Vernacular buildings, again, there was not a lot of formality. Many of our current universities were being developed and originally originated in the post-Civil War era, late 1800s and early 1900s. So a lot of the information one can actually find in some of these historical books that just took vernacular building construction principles and started capturing them. Some of the earliest books, especially coming out of the Civil War era, the late 1860s, and especially when we got into the 1870s, the development of correspondence-related types of institutions and learnings, the development of engineering principles. Again, all of these came about just through the practices that were part of journeymanship and the trades of how builders just passed this information down and eventually started being captured in books. And then the whole aspect of the Industrial Revolution and the engineering practices that came out of the aspects of building bridges in particular and how that rolled back into construction. So a little bit of insights on that, the combustibility, the fireproofing. So we have fireproof, non-fireproof. We have aspects dealing with voids, collapse, fire extension, the aspects of those buildings. And then certainly some of the major influences that occurred within the New York City metropolitan area with the development of various codes as a result of immigration. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we continue on. Let me just check our studio board here. So again, so actually, I guess we do have, I was just going to make mention that if we've got any of our listeners that are out there, our call-in number is 760-454-8852 for any of our guests that want to listen in. And let's see who I've got here. They've been on hold, and hopefully they're still here for a period of time. So let me see if I can bring that individual in. All righty. Who do I have on the line here?
Oh, hey, Chris. It's Bud Henkels.
Hey, Bud. Nice to hear your voice there. I saw you were on hold. I was just coming off of one screen and just poked into the other here. So
That's okay.
For popping in, not a problem. You probably went on hold for what, about 15 minutes or more?
Oh, no, it's okay. I just it's my first chance to get to sit down today, so I'm just as happy.
Oh, that's good.
Great points you're hitting on. I mean, some of the authors of some of the books you were going through, I actually had a few of those. While I was getting my apprenticeship through the state of Pennsylvania for, you know, journeyman carpenter, which is about 4 years long. I did have the Poole and Johnson and the Adele book. Once I got involved with early American restoration and period restoration, there's a group of a series of books. It's called The Architectural Treasures of American Early America. I don't know whether you've ever heard of that.
I have. That's a great level of insight here to let our listeners know. You know, there is such a wealth of books that are out there, but the fire service has just not been privy to it. I mean, we are very fortunate, you, myself, and a number of us that have consistently been on our radio programs, have been exposed to those through a variety of other educational and technical pursuits. So expand a little bit further about that. I want to give our listeners a little bit more insight on that.
Okay. The one I have here, and I do believe it's a four or five volume set, and it is the author of it is, hold on here a second, Roy Underhill is the consultant for it. And Lisa C. Moulton Mullins is the editor for it. And this one in particular that I have is Early American Community Structures, which is basically through the 1800s into the very early 1900s. I don't know whether you knew it or not, but my son, Chris, was a period blacksmith for Colonial Williamsburg. And I learned so much by going to Williamsburg for 20 years or more. I've been a member of the society there for probably 25 years. And, you know, it's just it's a wealth of learning down there as far as early types of construction, the methods you were talking about, brick making, especially when it came to steel and iron, you know, which my son, this is what he did. They had a process where they have you ever heard of a bloomery?
Yes.
Where they actually smelt their own iron by building this ceramic-type blast furnace. And it's actually called, they break the bottom of it, which they call the bloom, and then out comes the actual molten iron. But it's called blister steel is what they call it. And then they take that steel and they form it, and then they can forge anything that they pretty much want out of it. But it's really something to see, Chris. I don't know whether you ever had the chance to ever see something like that.
And that you know, these kinds of insights, of if our listeners can understand, and especially when we talk about older Type 3 construction, the Type 3 construction of the vintage of the 18 and early 1900s, but even the vintage of what I always call, and I use the Civil War era sort of as a demarcation. There, and again, guys, there's an overlap. There's not a distinctive, well, you know, it's the 1865 and going forward, and then that stuff in the back. There's quite a bit of a gray overlap, but distinctively, building construction and principles and methodologies, those in the early 1800s, the midpoint, post-Civil War era, and as technology started becoming more developed, we see these changes in methodologies and practices of how we developed the use of materials, and again, materials and the methodologies behind them and how our buildings were built. So there's just so much more into it, you know, but just like you're talking about here with steel construction. So we talk about forged steel, we talk about wrought iron, we talk about cast iron, we talk about the early development stages of structural steel, late 1800s, early 1900s. As these different materials went into these buildings, and as you know, more than any of our listeners know, you know, the manner in which these buildings were constructed relied on a certain set of principles that were typically handed down to a particular area, area and region by the workmanship, by the journeymen and the masters and so forth. And it wasn't until some of these individuals started putting them into book formats. And that's when we started getting this level of knowledge that was developed and carried on.
Definitely. I mean, a lot of connections and the influence that wrought iron, you know, forged iron had on construction down there was pretty substantial, especially when it came to ornamental work. A lot of the church down there, the Bruton Parish Church, I can name 1,000 buildings probably. And you can see the ideas and the methods that they used for their iron, you know, and of course they made their own nails. With the reconstruction of Colonial Williamsburg, there was a blacksmith shop there which my son worked in, is the James Anderson shop. And when James Anderson was in business for himself in the middle 1750s or so, he employed young boys as nothing but they, like 10 or 12, and they were just called nailers. And that's all they did was make nails 10, 12 hours a day. As you can even imagine, they could turn a nail around in about 30 seconds from the raw stock to a rose head type nail. And my son can do the same thing, which is pretty amazing. But this was the way, this was the beginning of actually starting to use, getting away from, there were still obviously lots of, you know, mortise and tenon, joinery, brace frame, whatnot. Everywhere you look, there's hand-forged nails, you know, used. Different types, clinch nails, rose heads. My son knows them all, and he can pretty much make them all. But it's really a great wealth of learning going down there. And I was fortunate enough to get into some of the buildings and get up into the attics and see how they framed and whatnot. And these living history museums are wonderful, the presentations they put on, but people like us, you know, we always have our high beams on, is what I say. And we're looking at cornice work, we're looking at this, we're looking at that. And it's just every time I've gone there, I've found something different. And I've been going there for 25 years. And the amazing fact, you'll like this one, Chris, is that the archaeologists that do the work for Colonial Williamsburg, when they're unearthing a building that has been missing for 250 years, I talked to one of the archaeologists there, and I said, where do you get your most information? He says, believe it or not, we find our most information from the fireplace. Whatever the homeowner used at that time, they threw it in the fireplace. He says, we can dig down 2 feet and tell you who was probably living here, what they were eating, this, that, and the other thing. So it's extremely interesting how they go about the forensics when it comes to building construction and the original footprint and watching it come up out of the ground, you know, in its original form, because they still use, obviously, all period methods of building there. I can't say enough about it. My son doesn't work there anymore, but in his 8 years that he worked there, I learned so much about metallurgy, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
How to tell wrought iron from cast iron and cold rolled steel as opposed to hot rolled.
Yep.
Just by looking at the end grain, the molecular structure of it. And my son even pointed out failures, what they call hot shorts, when they're forging out a piece of iron where the grain of the steel goes an opposite way, and that's a failure point. So teach an old dog new tricks, I guess you could say, Chris. But interesting nonetheless. But a lot of things you talked about tonight, fire cut beams, from a contractor's level, which I am, we are still doing that today, obviously. And I have seen remnants of failures where it does work. I mean, it's proven, and and I have seen it personally where the joists have gave way and the wall stood, or part of it dropped in instead of dropping out. So some really good points there. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You know, and again, it's the proof and concept is exactly what it is. Part of the challenge that, and I think you can certainly validate that, is that we have a fire service that has very distinctive levels of awareness, experience, and knowledge. And for some of our listeners, and it's always, and again, you probably see it too as you're teaching, you know, that this might be the first time someone in our audience has ever heard of this fire cut or, you know, a bevel cut or the fact that there's buildings that have these in there. I mean, I can remember vividly the first time I was exposed to it saying, you know, these old buildings that are a dime a dozen in our area back in that day, you know, have a type of characteristic that from the fire service standpoint, one needs to be aware of, because guess what, guys, the floor will collapse if you're on top of it or underneath it. And, you know, so it's a continuing cycle for us to make a new generation of fire service personnel aware of these principles.
Right.
And certainly the thing that all of us continue to strive to do is to impart upon the fire service this level of knowledge and insight that all of us are so passionate about regarding the built environment. And especially when there's practical insights and the practical insights that you bring, that I bring, Mike Latina, Brian Bastinelli, that Doug Klein. I mean, there's this whole group of us that, and many others. I certainly don't want to limit it to just this particular group that I'm mentioning.
Sure.
But those that are involved in teaching building construction, especially those that really are critical thinkers and just go beyond just regurgitating book learning, but have these insights, just like our conversation right now, that's the kind of information that hopefully will impart upon some young firefighter or an officer or some old salt commander to revisit some book or to pick up another document or pick up any one of the books that we just talked about and gain some more insight. And maybe someday, somewhere in the street, somewhere, it's going to make a difference of
absolutely
saving the building or, more importantly, saving a brother or sister's life.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, in regards to the fire cut, I mean, it is obviously part of my program. I do have a simulator that I can show how it works, you know, me and my props. I can't speak without them. It's like being a ventriloquist and with my little dummy. Without them, I'm nobody. But anyways, but I usually hold up a piece of timber with an angle cut on it, and I'll just say, does anybody know what this is? Obviously, they say, oh, it's a piece of timber. I said, no. I said, why is it cut like this? And truthfully, Chris, only maybe 30% of the class would ever say, oh, that's a fire cut. It's a little bit disturbing, you know. That's kind of like bread and butter things you should have known a long time ago, but it just makes me realize what's not being taught.
Yes,
as far
exactly.
as, like I said, obvious things that you should know, not even getting close to what's out there engineered-wise. I mean, that's a whole different universe. But just the basics of it. I mean, I get so many guys that, wherever I teach, even in Philly, and say, they're not teaching us that. And it's a shame because a city from where I live in the Philadelphia area, I mean, we're saturated with type 3, and obviously type 4 too, and the whole gamut. And it's a very important thing, though. Like you said, type 3 is one of the most unpredictable, type construction prone to collapse and all that. That's something very interesting that happened to me this week or 2 weeks ago. Like we say, keep your eyes open, know your local. And well, they're doing a renovation in the town that I protect, and it's a type 3, and it's a restaurant, and it's right in the middle of town. It's a row of type 3 buildings. There are some are touching one another, some are setbacks about maybe 3 feet in between. But what I noticed was that on the A side, they had taken down the whole front of the building. They're going to rebuild the whole front, new facade. And I'm looking up at it, and I said, gee, I didn't know there was a cock loft above that. It wasn't really in the read the way I'm reading the windows and what's above the larger space above it. So I drove past again, and I looked at it, and here – to my surprise, it wasn't a cock loft at all. At some point in time, you're talking about building evolutions and the changes that it goes through. They actually built a rain roof over top of the flat roof, but the rain roof was actually slightly pitched, where they took the parapet on the D and B side and lowered the parapet a certain pitch, and they built a flat roof over top of another flat roof. So.
Yep.
Here we go again. A rain roof or a roof over doesn't have to be peaked. So if you're constantly looking for something that's a rain roof is usually peaked. Well, it's not. And as I'm looking at it, I said, now would you still consider that a cock loft? Because there's about a 3 foot space up there. I don't know whether you could. I don't think you really could. Only because that. It's not really, ceiling material up there to get through. You still got to get through the decking that's on that original first roof section. So, but I watched what they did, and they pretty much closed it up, and now the whole front of the building is all new material. It's AZAC, it's Dryvit, it's this, that, and the other thing. All composites, all plastics, and all that, and. I believe they were using FIPON and AZAC to do all the new corners work with, and it's beautiful now. But it was just that small window of time that I was able to drive past and take some pictures of it. Yeah.
And
so it just
so
pays
key,
to pay attention.
Exactly.
It really
does. And again, our listeners should just really listen in on the importance. So one of the major takeaways of that is that you've got to be engaged in and observant to what's occurring in your own backyard. If you're at the corner of, you know, you're at a street corner at a stoplight, you know, are you looking to the left? Are you looking to the right? Whether you're in your private vehicle or you're in the fire engine, you know, what is occurring? And then if you do see something, stop and invest a little bit of time to ask some questions of whoever the builder is or the superintendent or the job foreman, the occupant or owner. You know, gain some insights and then take that information back to your station or share it with your company. It's just so important to stay engaged with that types of observation. And I learned that as a skill set level very early on by some of the senior salt of our department. And we just, you know, gained that insight saying, look, it, go out and buff and observe fires. Go out and observe what's going on from a construction standpoint. It becomes so imperative. And so, you know, one thing came to mind here when you're talking about that cockloft area is, you know, one of the things that I've seen also has been, and we always talk about just roof rafters within our type 3s, but the one thing that I seldom hear talked about to any extent, and I think it's just a lack of awareness and a lack of understanding, but very often you will find either 6 or 10 panel tow trusses that are actually configured up into the roof areas with the various types of purlins on top of the roof system. So, so when we look at the types of and the tow truss was very, very common in that late the mid to late 1800s as a structural assembly that went typically. More often than not, it went from the Bravo to sides, you know, bearing wall to bearing wall.
Yep.
And then occasionally you might find them going, and again, in a single slow pitch from front to rear, where you have a very substantial parapet going from Alpha to Charlie. So it's just an item of note. And for many of our listeners, you may not even have a clue of what we're talking about. But look up what a how truss is, number one. And typically this how truss, again, we'll have a top and bottom cord with the various types of webbing in the various panels. But the 6 or 10 panel is, again, that span between a particular web member that's going to be part of the triangular piece. But these are truss systems that are up in our roof systems that we never, I should say this, we seldom to ever talk about them in type 3s, but are very, very common in type 3 construction in certain locales around the country, especially in the Northeast. So I just wanted to throw that out there because, again, it just led right into this observation. You take a look at rain roofs. Do I have raftered systems? Do I have my roof joists, my ceiling joists? Do I have these voids that are present? How many voids? And, again, the lessons learned out of wall bombs fired and many, many other fires that had concealed space conditions up there.
Yeah, if we had an incident in this building, obviously we would have never known. And now that I know, you know, it's already in our information in the engine. It's in our files now that there is still a roof over an existing roof. Now I don't know. It makes you wonder what other buildings were treated the same way. We just don't know, you know, there, like I said, we do have a lot of class 3 that's class 3, and we have balloon frame that's actually in our downtown section of where I live. I was just fortunate because, like I said, once it's covered up, siding and exterior enclosures and sheathings hide a multitude of sins.
Yep. The other thing that you just made mention of is the treatment. So the modern treatment relative to facades from an architectural standpoint may very well give you the appearance of classical heritage construction, you know, having the design features and motifs and so forth, but it's a different type of material, guys. So some of the things that Bud just talked about regarding certain types of materials, its application, even the drive-it systems, I mean, be aware that architects and designers have available to them a variety of different materials that can be utilized to give you a certain look that is non-functional, but may give you this false sense of what the building is or what it may not be. So, especially with the drive-in. The introduction, I can remember when I worked as an architect, the introduction of the of that fastened styrofoam system, and again, drive-in being a particular brand, and we started using it back in the early 1980s. It was the newest thing on the block, and it was like, man, this is great. You can cover over the old brick or sheathing material. You mechanically fasten and apply the material. It's got a reinforcement mesh, and then it has a variety of different type of cementitious coating that you can just do
with. I think one of the greatest things about Drive-It was that you had more control over color, since everything was all latex pre-mixed, as opposed to, you know, natural cement-based stucco, which can change in color. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, it was like the latest and greatest in sliced bread when that showed up, Drive-It. and was really a lot more on the commercial side. And then it eventually, got over to the residential side, because when I first started out in the trade.
It originated, you're absolutely correct, but it originated in commercial applications.
And we
used it extensively in that application. And then, again, it was based upon code allowances, when the codes became modified to allow the introduction of, guess what, combustible material based upon
material, right.
You know, into the residential setting, which was, you didn't put it on wood framing. You had to have a backing and a sheathing material to have some type of rating and so forth.
Yep.
So some great points from there. But, that's all part of it. So.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, I would be remiss if I didn't say this while you were on the air here. You know, we always talk about some of the key reports that are out there, and one of the key reports that we always talk about, whether we're talking about type 4, in this instance, it's a combination of both of those types or classifications, but the York Street fire in the city of Philadelphia on April 9th of 2012. NIOSH report F2012-13. Again, significant report, guys. If you've never heard about this event, download the NIOSH report 2012-13, the York Street fire on April 9th, 2012 in the city of Philadelphia. Double line of duty deaths with tremendous degree of lessons and learnings, which we, again, were allowed to expand upon significantly within that report on characteristics and attributes of type 3 and type 4 construction. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage our listeners to download that report. So for you and I, that is a significant it has a lot of meaning to it in a variety of different ways.
Based upon our
relationship with the city of Philadelphia and many of our brothers and sisters there.
And Vince put together an excellent program, which I know has been shown at FDIC, about lessons learned from Buck Hosiery. And he's a very good friend, of course, of you too. And he does incredible work. When Vince digs his fingernails into something, it's usually a good product that's going to come out on the other end. Especially, you know, when we went through our row house series and the death of Matt, you know, Laterno, fantastic. I mean, just a really in-depth prying and probing, and I learned a lot from that. You know, the use of hemlock, which they shouldn't have, but they just didn't know. You know, it's just one of those
again,
things.
You know, 100-something years later, we end up gaining these insights on challenging construction features, and just, you know, moving it forward to gain those kinds of insight. So again, for our listeners, we're actually referring back to our podcast that we put out as part of our series. I made mention of that in the early part of our program here on this episode. We did a series of podcasts back in the end of it was about a year ago, so October, November, December of 2020, and we're making reference back to Captain Matt Laterno, lieutenant at the time, but the Matt Laterno building collapse on the Colorado Street fire in a row house application that occurred on January 6th of 2018,
Six, yes.
and, that, And that report was issued in 2018, or excuse me, it's report number 2018-03, and that was issued out in July of 2020. So just another takeaway for our listeners here on another significant report that really gets into Type 3 construction relative to row house and row frame construction, of which these are so, so common. So again, some really great insight. Well, listen, you know, you and I'm actually going to be in Philly coming up here next month. So hopefully we'll have a chance to see each other. I'm going to be at
Are you coming to Intersets? Are you coming to Intersets?
I will be
okay,
there.
Okay, great.
And we'll have a chance to spend a little time talking about some things. So
Based
upon my time here, I've got a couple of other key items here to finish up with our listeners. But, you know, again, Bud, Bud is actually, he doesn't know this yet, but he probably should, by knowing how we operate here. But we made mention of our fourth installment here that'll be coming up next month. And Bud will certainly, I'm hoping his availability will be available, but we're going to be wrapping up our series here and really just talking about how many of these buildings continue to evolve into newer types of structures, both commercial, retail, and more importantly, multiple occupancies. And again, the entire metropolitan area of Philadelphia that you've had firsthand insights on continues with this trend with our Type 3 buildings and our Type 4 occupancies that are evolving into this new type of adaptive reutilization of our buildings. So Bud will be part of that, and hopefully, again, you'll be available for our
there is a huge explosion of that, renovating type 5 here in Philadelphia, turning it into, you know, high-end condos and areas of the city where you wouldn't even think you wanted to live. But now it's becoming, they're moving further out of the center city area to the more affordable areas of like Northern Liberties, which you would know, Port Richmond, Frankfurt, all that. Of the Type 5 construction, big mill-type buildings that are left, many have burned down over the years, including Buck Hosiery. But, there's such a variety of things to see and do here in Philadelphia. And we hope that Intersets is going to, prove that to everybody. It's new for everybody. It's new for me, too. So I'll have a busy October because I'll be there, and then I'll be out to see John Schaefer for the Indiana State Fire Instructors Conference. Teaching out there, too. So
The symposium there that John offers.
The symposium,
there, just outside of Indianapolis.
I think I'm presenting on the 27th of October. Yep.
Excellent. Very, very good. Well, busy month ahead. So, all right, Bud, thanks very much for dropping in. Very much for the insights here.
Thank you very much. Always entertaining, and I just
certainly
love it.
It certainly is. It's always very informative. Thanks for your insights. They were exceptional here tonight, as they always are. So thanks very much. So, excellent.
And you know what I'm going to do, Chris? Yep. I'm going to send you some I'll forward some information for you for some of these books that I have.
Okay.
And give you some shots of that building I shot here in Philadelphia.
If Bud sends his list out, I'll combine that with my continuously growing list. And if our listeners are out there and you want our list of some of these books that are they're not always available, but many times you will find them on a variety of different on Abe's Books, on Thrift Books, on Amazon.
Yeah.
There's a variety of different online services.
Yeah.
There's some great book antique book sites online that you can find some of these.
Absolutely.
Books. But I would really encourage our listeners, if you heard us talking about these books, they really are probably more important than some of the tactical books that one always strives to get, but they will give you the kinds of details and information that is just not typically available in any other resource. So
don't ever discount the information in old books. Seriously.
Absolutely not.
There's so much to learn.
That certainly is the case. So again, thanks very much for your insights,
Chris,
here, and we'll look forward to talking to you next month.
You got it, sir.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, brother.
Stay safe, brother. You're welcome.
You too. Good night.
Good night. So that's, Bud's out of the Philadelphia metro area, and some great insights for those of you that have an opportunity to take some of his classes. Again, many of us instruct on a national basis, and Bud has expanded his opportunity and footprint well beyond just the confines of the downstate area of Pennsylvania and the Philly metropolitan area. But also, again, if you're able to listen to him on the road somewhere, I would really encourage you. If any of our listeners are out in the Indianapolis area, again, he'll be out there at John Schaefer's sponsored Building Construction Symposium. Great series. Certainly expanded. I had the opportunity to teach out there a couple of years ago. Chief Jerry Tracy out of FDNY and I both co-taught over the course of a couple of days, and some really great insights. And again, if you have the opportunity, go online on Bud's Facebook pages. We'll take a look at some of the phenomenal three-dimensional modeling that Bud is able to produce, and that's also available for order and purchase. So just a quick little plug for him based upon some of the things that continues to promote, that all of us promote, how to learn about our buildings for those of us that are so immersed in this. And we live, breathe it, and it's all part of what and how we do things. So we've talked about a variety of different elements here so far, really leading into some different topical items. And again, we started talking a little bit about construction and the aspects of the building codes. And again, I don't want to get into it too much further along, only because there is quite a bit of information on it. But I'll leave you one quick item here. When we talked about the issues of the National Building Code, especially in the 1900s or 1905, to be very specific, so 1905, the first edition of the formative development of the National Building Code, which was issued by the National Board of Fire Underwriters. So 1905 was that first edition. 1915, it became much more established. It became really the first code of record that cities could adopt that really gave us much of what we're talking about here, different requirements on how the walls and floors were constructed, what type of spacing, the application and the use of spreader plates, for an example, and reinforcement of walls, the first introduction of various types of standards for single or double stirrups that were used to provide for the support of, they were actually, for better words, they were the first joist hangers that were being utilized many times of either wrought, forged, or cast iron, but typically of wrought or wrought iron applications and such. So variety of different elements, turnbuckles, cabling, spreader plates that were tied in, typically wrought iron. And again, these are the formulations of how these buildings were built. The only thing I want to make, and again, the reason I was leading down this path is that when we talk about code classification, so in the late to early 1900s, as building construction was starting to become, in the very, very early stages, some degree of standardization, the classifications of our buildings in 1905, for example, type 1 was called frame construction. Type 2, which was called non-fireproof construction, had two different subsets. It included ordinary construction and mill construction. So that was considered non-fireproof, ordinary, and mill construction. And then the third classification, which was pretty simple, was a fireproof construction. And fireproofing was provided by a variety of different elements, plaster and lath, terracotta tile, various other types of configurations. But the most simplest application of some degree of fireproofing was the application of plaster and lath, or the utilization of a metal, which was a tin, and that tin would typically provide some degree of fire resistiveness between the compartment and the void. And those voids would include the wall and typically the ceiling, the floor joist. So how do I minimize the extension of fire, which was very common in our type 3s, from extending from a compartment fire, a room and contents, into the structure, or extending up? Because again, one of the challenges with this construction were the voids that were present, and the ability for fire to propagate and extend very, very rapidly in various floor areas throughout the building, obviously affecting the survivability of the occupants. Let's see, I want to talk a little bit more about a couple of code items here just to tie back into some elements dealing with the NFPA 220 standards. So let me just, I'm checking some of my notes here. So so we made mention of the 1900s to around 1915. In 1930, a major change, and as some of the code started becoming more refined, the origination of the Southern Building Code, the Uniform Building Code is an example, which were extensions of the National Building Code, we started seeing some changes in classifications of our buildings. In 1930, the class or types of buildings also changed again. So we had Class 1 or Type 1, which were called fireproof structures. We had Class 2, which were fire-protected structures. Class 3 or Type 3, which were non-fireproof. Class 4 or Type 4, wood frame. Class 5, which was metal structures. And then Class 6, which was referred to as heavy timber. Now, some of you may recognize that this terminology actually still exists in some jurisdictions. If you go to New York City, for an example, Class 3 construction is, or excuse me, the classifications of that construction was common to, again, the referencing of those six classifications that I just made reference to. So some of these things have legacy that just have longevity to them, but again, these classifications also affected how the buildings were protected, along with the types of construction that went into the buildings. There's also some referencing back to the codes based upon whether buildings were residential, public buildings, or business buildings. So that first National Building Code referred to three different classifications, the first being public buildings, Class Alpha and Bravo, residencies, Class Charlie and Delta, and then businesses, which were Echo and Foxtrot. So those of you that have some further insights or want to get into some further details on that, I would encourage you to take a look at some of those particular elements. So predominantly, codes changed dramatically between 1867. 1867 is important to know because that was the Tenement Housing Act, which actually put in place some of the things that we're talking about with our Type 3s, the establishment of certain criteria in terms of access points, wall configurations, window configurations, size, the introduction of fire escapes within the building. So 1867, the Tenement Act, which originated in New York City, actually had implications throughout the United States in that era of time, all the way through and up to including 1968, when some major changes started occurring, all the way through the modernization of our codes into the to the development of the International Code or Building Code in the late 1990s, early 2000s. So what we're referring back to is that the building types that we utilize today, types 1 through 5, were not present in the same format as we are talking about here today. So it's important to understand that and reference those things out. Even the introduction of the the NFPA 220 standard. So the introduction of the NFPA 220 didn't take place until 1953. And again, that's when we started seeing the standardization of our codes and our classifications that we have now become familiar with. So just recognize those changes, the NFPA 220 standard, the NFPA 1 code, the 101 code, just the changes, again, when we talk about the National Building Code, Southern Building Code, the BOCA code, the Uniform Building Code. Again, there's different elements here that all eventually were consolidated into what we currently know as part of the International Building Code and the International Fire Code that, again, are uniform from that particular standpoint. So, again, I don't want to belabor that. We've sort of lost a little bit of time from that. But, again, these are very, very important items to note. As we made mention of, just the introduction of the bevel cut and the introduction of and the standardization of utilizing reinforcement on our bearing walls. So the introduction of this of the spreader plates and the fact that they were formalized in 1894 is very, very important to know. That's when, again, it was by code or by regulatory standards at the time that buildings of type 3 construction would have these types of spreader plates within the buildings that were tied back into the structural elements of either floor or roof diaphragms and would help provide stability to the perimeter walls, which is an important element here when we talk about those particular aspects. So let's talk a little bit more about some aspects on our collapse construction here. And let me take a couple of quick notes here out. So I made mention a little bit about some of the old reference books. So I'm going to give you some insights on that came out of the 1948 edition, which is the 10th edition of the NFPA Handbook of Fire Protection. Again, it still was called the Crosby, Fisk, and Forster book. The 10th edition, which was issued, first issue was 1948. Prior to 1948, if you go back to and actually look at the 10th edition, the 9th edition. The 9th edition was issued out in 1943, so 1941. So between 1941 and the issuance of the 10th edition in 1948, that seven-year span, in 1948 we saw the first referencing regarding the effects of heat expansion on ordinary masonry walls. And some of you may recall this based upon some readings, especially if you've been around in the fire service for 30 years or more. Many of our earlier books that for some of us were introduced to the aspects of ordinary construction back in the late 70s and early 80s, they talked about the coefficient of expansion, the aspects of the heating of the interior portion of the building, and primarily heat differentials. So the inside compartment fires affecting the inside walls of a masonry building, and the application of water, which was typically done in a combination from both the outside as well as interior. So interior attack, outside attack. But again, this is all the pre era of self-contained breathing apparatus, and the application of water from the exterior portion of the building still was very, very common. Much of what was discussed and the first instances of talking about how buildings would fail regarding collapse zones on the outside was made reference in that 10th edition in 1948. So in 1948, they were talking about ordinary masonry construction, assuming that there was no explosion or any type of internal pressure. So they started recognizing some of the aspects of fire dynamics causing pressurization of the interior of the compartment. But primarily the point being here is that at that point in time, they started talking about, based upon anecdotal information that had been passed on, that, again, based upon structural collapses and so forth, that establishing the collapse zone based upon one-third of the height of the wall area became part of what we learned and part of how we manage the perimeter of what commonly would be perimeter wall collapses. So one-third the height, but they also made reference that, again, ordinary masonry construction, assuming no explosion or internal pressure, will fall within a distance from the wall equal to one-third its height. But bricks may bounce or roll further. So they made reference to that, talked about heat expansion. There's a great graphic that was carried on all the way through the I think it was till the early 1990s, that just showed the firefighter applying water to the exterior and that one-third of that wall collapsing down and being the collapse zone. What we have now become much more aware of is that that does not has not typically been correct. Our typical collapse zone increment is 1.5 times the height horizontally, and that's a conservative number with considerations based upon the height of the building. So again, as the height increases, so does the thickness of the wall, so does the mass of that wall, and one has to certainly consider sometimes an increased collapse zone horizontally. Now that very well may not be the case where you don't have the ability to go horizontal in street side until you hit another curb, hit another building. So we may not have 1.5 or 2 two times the height of the building to be that horizontal area, which means you have to either do two things. You have to either exclude personnel from operating in that street based upon the height of the building and the proximity of an exposure across the street, or have personnel operating in a collapse zone for whatever the prioritized reasons may be under the highest degree of risk, but based upon whatever the parameters are dictated for incident priority. So just recognize that sometimes certain things have to occur, but if we have the availability and those options, one should not be operating within the collapse zone, and that collapse zone conservatively should be at least as a minimum 1.5 times the height with a little bit of overlap for the distance and the potential bounce of building material, which, again, have maimed, killed, and injured firefighters countlessly time over time. It doesn't take a massive parapet or stone cornice to cause the injury. It's just one brick that equates back to about three pounds that has velocity and hits the mass of a firefighter either in the torso area or in the head or some other extremity that may cause significant damage or result in a fatality. Another item of note here that I want to make reference, especially with our Type 3 construction, is that bonding area. So based upon how a building is configured and the manner in which a wall may connect to the outside perimeter wall. So again, there's five critical elements of a building, one of which, when we talk about perimeter walls, as we have in the past, becomes very, very critical. And how that perimeter wall in masonry construction is bonded to other cross walls inside of that building will also have some apparent consideration on how that building will fail. Many of you may be familiar with what we've referred to as pilasters. They are both internal or external, and the infill construction in between them. So if I have infill construction between two pilasters or rigid points of construction that are part of my exterior wall, the tendency of that masonry construction to actually fail inward versus outward is just a manner of how the building was constructed and the manner in which the coefficients of expansion, how flame impingement, heat impingement will affect the construction. So just recognize that. And that, again, when we have the presence of pilasters, which are a structural element for internal or external on walls, the presence of those may actually help us by limiting potential wall failures and such. So just a quick little insight without the availability of any type of graphics from that standpoint here. So I just quickly want to move forward. I just want to talk a little bit more about some considerations of collapse. Just a couple of key items here. Let me make reference to just very quickly here. I think I want to talk about, I've talked a little bit about the aspects of construction and materials and so forth. I would encourage you, so we've made reference to the York Street collapse and report from Philadelphia, April 9th, 2012, double line of duty death, report, NIOSH report F-2012-13. Again, about 50 pages worth of information that you can download and get some further insights on what we've been talking about here on our other two episodes as well as here on our third installment on insights on brick and joist construction. We talked extensively about that incident, but also expanded the conversation and the narrative to talk about characteristics and other aspects of Type 3 and Type 4 construction. So if you're looking for that information, it's there to find. A couple of other reports here that we made reference to. The Matt Letourneau report, although dealing with row house, it was a row house of Type 3 construction, brick and joist construction. NIOSH report 2018-03, issued July 30th of 2020, for the incident, the line of duty death of Matt Letourneau that occurred on January 6th, 2018. So again, a lot of good documentable, downloadable information to expand upon our podcast to really give you the reinforcement of that information. And then the other report that there's actually three other reports, but the other report that is very, very important when we talk about bearing wall, masonry construction, the applications of load transfers and how they affect a building, And this occurred during concurrent operations in which both fire suppression as well as very, very demanding rescue operations were occurring. This occurred in Kansas City, Missouri, October 12th of 2015, double line of duty death, the collapse of a bearing wall. Again, report, NIOSH report, F-2015-15. That coupled with two other very, very important reports that when we talk about type 3 construction, again, mark this down, NIOSH report F-2009-23, Buffalo Fire Department in New York, August 24th, 2009, double line of duty death at the Genesee Street fire in which a in which Lieutenant Charles Chip McCarthy and firefighter Jonathan Kroom lost their lives while operating in a very innocuous 2,500 square foot type 3 mixed use occupancy commercial retail bodega on the first floor and residentials up above with a basement fire with a floor collapse. And the other significant report dealing with a floor collapse dealt with the 2006 event, August 27th of 2006, that occurred on Walton Avenue in the Bronx, which led to the line of duty death of Lieutenant Howard Karpluck and firefighter Michael Riley. The report number F-2006-27. So two significant events that we annually discuss and promote and make reference to in our Lessons from the Fireground series. We post them on our Twitter account, at Command Safety, and then also on Buildings on Fire on Facebook. We always reference these reports because of the lessons and learnings. But if you've never heard of these reports or the other two that we just referenced, I would encourage you to, again, go back, listen to what we just made mention of, the referencing of those reports, download those reports, and listen in on that information because, again, there's a tremendous amount of information that we have available that are out of those reports that further reinforces our conversation. So, again, a lot of what, when we talk about type 3s in particular, we have typically a reference back to old growth wood, wood that is fully dimensioned in its cross-section. It has mass. It has the ability to provide strength and stability to the structures, but also recognize that, again, they were different designs and spans and loads and capacities in a time and era in the 1800s, early 1900s, that was just starting to be developed. So there were inherent design features and other considerations, but nonetheless, these buildings still had much more robust capabilities of spans and loads. And all the, and typically there was a degree of redundancy, but at the same time there were other features in the buildings that worked against us. Again, the unreinforced masonry construction, the types of mortar mixture, the variations of various types of introduction of both masonry, wood, and other metal products. And by metal products we talk about, again, cast iron, forged materials, rolled structural steel, wrought iron, and so forth. So there was a combination there. But again, and the issues there is that we had mass and compression versus the engineered types of wood and treatments that we have currently today. So just some consideration. And that led me to a quick notation here is that if you want some good insights on the effects of heat and flame impingement on wood, and this is applicable not only to type 3 construction, but more importantly on our engineered construction. And I'm just looking, looking for my note here. I want to make reference to another significant event and fire, and I need to find, bear with me a moment here, the referencing back to another significant fire that occurred in Houston, Texas, and stand by. I'm trying to go back on memory here. So the referencing that I'm trying to refer to is the Southwest Inn fire, which occurred in Houston, Texas, which resulted in the line of duty death of four firefighters at that event, but also ended up leading to a fifth firefighter fatality of the captain in that particular operation. I was hoping I had my reference back to the Southwest Inn report. I don't have that in front of me, but that referencing back to that fire and report, we did time talking about the aspects of wood loss, the cross-section of wood or mass, smoldering issues, fire growth, and so forth. So I just want to make reference to that. Again, when we talk about softwood paralysis, we talk about charring at the rate of 1 inch, typically to the loss of wood or paralysis based on charring, the loss of 1 inch per 40 to 45 minutes of a flame exposure or impingement at 14 to 1600 degrees Fahrenheit. That equals to 1.5 inches per 60 minutes, which equals primarily to a quarter inch loss of mass or wood per 10 minutes of fire exposure. So just recognize that if we have an understanding of what's burning, how it's being affected, whether it be flame impingement or heat impingement on a material, based upon how it was constructed and built, that will also relate back to the tactical windows of opportunity that one has when we talk about operating on the fire ground in terms of, again, that 10-minute critical window of fire ground operations in this day and age. I want to make reference back to, again, some of the aspects of action and reactions, the aspects of surface to mass ratios, and also the aspects of load transfers. We do have other material that within that structure, again, especially if it has some type of metal basis to it, has the opportunity to soften, elongate, bend, or buckle. And I'll just quickly give you a couple of quick bullets here. Again, cold-drawn steel, 50% loss of strength at 800 degrees Fahrenheit. Structural steel, the elongation is 10 inches at 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Extruded steel, 50% loss of strength at 1,100 degrees Fahrenheit. Light gauge metal components will fail with impingement, just in flame impingement, at a degree temperature of 800 to 1,000 degrees within 10 to 14 minutes. So just some quick insights here on that I wanted to pass along. And again, there's some other insights here. We could talk about cast iron, wrought iron. Again, just recognize that there's a lot of, for better words, a lot of anecdotal information that's out there talking about the aspects of cast iron and again, steaming issues within the confines of the casting and failure and so forth. We'll actually leave that for another point of conversation to possibly get into some critical workings about cast iron. Cast iron is typically present in a variety of configurations, not just the facade configuration on the outside perimeter walls, which is more common, but you very well may find a cast iron column that may be present in absence of a wooden column within the confines of a Type 3 constructed building, or you very well may find a series of cast iron columns internal when we have a variety of different bay areas within a heavy timber constructed building. So, there's quite a bit of insights that one can provide relative to cast iron, which we will leave for another session and conversation. I'll make reference to this here. So one of the things that we were, for some of you that follow us on our Twitter page and on our Facebook page, a couple of days ago we made reference to a new series that we're going to announce. We're going to strike the box and make some announcements on Monday, September 20th, about an upcoming series of opportunities for all of you that are out there listening to our podcast. Primarily these are going to be webinars and some expanded opportunities online, both that are coming up here in the October, November, December timeframe. We're actually going to be doing a Main Street series called Main Street Old School Hazards for Today's Fireground. This will be a five-part webinar series, 2 hours in duration. That's going to commence on January 3rd, and it'll be throughout the entire month of January, 5 sessions, 2 hours in length, talking about, again, much of what we started to do with our podcasting here on these insights, but just talking about old school hazards, talking about building performance, but also utilizing visuals that are so, so important. Our second part, we'll talk about Type 3 and 4 construction and structural systems. The third installment will be roofs, cornices, facades, storefronts, and accessories. the fourth installment, Characteristics of Compromised Collapse and Case Studies, and then the fifth episode, Alterations, Renovations, and Adaptive Reuses. So, again, webinar-based, but we're rolling out an entire series of offerings that will be coming about, tying into some things that we're doing with fire engineering, but also some webinar series that you'll find that can be independently taken, but an entire series of concentrated web-based programming here to really expand upon what we call our Fireground Architect series in our Buildings on Fire programming here. So just stay tuned for that with our webinars, our lecture series, and some really cool things coming about to really wrap the stuff together. So I want to make reference just to a couple of other items here when we talk about collapse and compromise. Recognize this. So we talked about And actually, we have not talked about it in this episode. I think we talked a little bit about it in episode two of our series. We talked about some benchmarking relative to the tactical windows. Now, some of you may have heard, and again, and some of you may not, but the 20-minute rule. Some of you still utilize the 20-minute rule on today's fireground. I know that for a fact, just based upon the opportunities of traveling around the United States here over the last number of years. Actually the last 35 years, but certainly over the last 10 to 15 or 20 years, it just, again, astounds me where, again, just this lack of understanding of what the true benchmarks are for tactical windows on today's firegrounds with our fire loading, the megawatts of energy, the manner in which our buildings are being constructed, the hybrid construction, and so forth. So 20-minute rule is antiquated at best. It was based upon tenement firefighting back in the 40s and 50s and became pretty much the way we did business all the way up through to the mid-1980s. The 20-minute rule just primarily says, hey, you've got 20 minutes of fireground operational time before some bad things could occur. And that was inclusive of both behavioral-based issues with fire dynamics, the flashover and backdraft issues, but more importantly, they are also referred back to perimeter walls and other things that could occur resulting in compromise and or collapse. Well, again, if you are relying on the 20-minute rule, it doesn't take much readings to realize that compromising conditions in buildings start occurring much earlier, especially within the context of from time of fire origination versus from time of dispatch. So we've got this unknown time frame of fire impingement and fire dynamics occurring within the building. We get the call. Call comes in. It's being processed. Reflex time. We go out on the street. So all we do know is from time of dispatch, time of arrival, the clocks should be ticking in. And we typically have a 10-minute window that one has to be monitoring upon our arrival with other considerations to start monitoring building performance as we engage within the building. And the reason I bring this up, I just want to talk about the issues of compromise on collapse, time and benchmarks relative to Type 3 construction. So it used to be Type 3 construction, 20 minutes of operational time. More often than not, there would be some indication that adverse conditions were occurring, which would give us enough time to identify, communicate, and then react, and hopefully get out of harm's way. Well, that's certainly not the case. We started seeing this certainly in the 1980s and into the 1990s. I won't get into the details of that, but there is a whole story about that. We actually talked about aspects of time and benchmarking on Chief Doug Klein's program a couple of months back, and we actually spent about an hour and a half talking about them and the pros and cons of from time of dispatch, from time of response, time of arrival, time of first line, and so forth, and what that all meant, some of the implications of the 1980s as they relate here in the 2020 era. But I'll give you this, and again, we've got this documented out in a variety of different areas, and hopefully it's not the first time you may have heard this. But as it relates back to Type 3 construction, from 0 minutes to 15 minutes, and again, this is based upon from time of arrival, one can anticipate the fact that collapse has to be considered. Some degree of predictability and projections that compromising and potential for collapse is there, whether it be within the compartment, the assembly of the system, or certainly the perimeter walls of the floor and or roof. So again, it's all going to be contingent upon the degree of fire, heat and smoke, the propagation, the impingement, and the severity and the growth potential. So there's a lot of working parts here. But 0 to 15, you can certainly anticipate that. normal course of operations, and the probability of something adverse occurring would be considered what we call occasional. It's a moderate level of risk. You start getting into the plus or minus 15 to around 20 minutes plus. And we utilize a little bit more than 20 minutes, around 23 or so, give or take. You could expect collapse. So if you're still working in or around the building, you typically have about a 15-minute elapsed time that's occurred. Collapse is much more highly predictable if you're in or around that building, and certainly if you're in or under. It becomes a marginal severity of risk, and the likelihood and probability of collapse is increased to a level of high, meaning it's not occasional, but it's likely. You start operating 23 to 30 minutes, collapse is impending. In other words, it's very likely that it's going to occur. The severity level becomes critical. You have about 25 minutes of elapsed time that you've operated on, and again, the probability now becomes extreme with a high degree of likeliness. If you are operating anywhere near, in or around 30 minutes plus, it's a precipitated level. So in other words, it's going to happen, and if it doesn't happen within the next minute or two, it's going to, or as we even talk about it, at the 30 minutes plus, it very well may be catastrophic. The likelihood and probability is frequent. So we start operating. We constantly see this time and time again. Personnel are operating 20, 25, 30 minutes, and then all of a sudden, you know, this unexpected collapse, as the reports indicate, ends up occurring. Well, it is predictable. It just wasn't expected because the personnel, the commanders, were not paying attention to the elapsed time. They were not monitoring building conditions. May not have had the degree of understanding of building predictability and performance related to the suppression and other efforts based upon priorities that are being undertaken. So again, recognize this, is that we very well may have to be operating in this extended operational window based upon the priorities of life safety for civilian either removal or location based upon those priorities and probabilities. In other words, we have to do what we have to do based upon those conditions that are in front of us, regardless of where the clock may be, but we have to have a sense of understanding of the severity and the potential of risk. So if we just understand them, it is what it may be. But if we're doing it with a degree of ignorance, then that's completely unacceptable, because one of the leading issues when we take a look at the root cause analysis of NIOSH reports and line of duty deaths, especially at the command level, when we take a look at one of the four elements there, is that it's the inability for commanding officers or commanders to recognize adverse conditions and react to them before they occur. In other words, being able to proactively react versus reactionary after the fact that, you know, the walls collapse, the floor's given way, mayday, mayday, and we go to work. So we just need to have a better understanding of this correlation of the tactical benchmarks, the elapsed time, and its relationship back to these types of buildings, their characteristics, their predictability, the assembly of the system, the perimeter walls, the floors, and the roofs, the degree of propagation impingement, the severity and the growth, both in terms of fire severity growth, but also incident severity and growth relative to life safety. So it's important to put these particular elements together. So, and lastly, I'll just make reference to a couple of items here when we talk about collapse and compromise characteristics. Again, when we take a look at collapse zones, again, the management of collapse zones is critical. At a minimum, we need to identify and establish and maintain a minimum of 1.5 or more times the height of the building. We have to have very effective and rigorous management of collapse zones. As soon as we have a lack of integrity or a lack of focus and commitment to those collapse zones, some bad things may end up occurring. And again, it's just understanding that although we may communicate that, we have to have a high degree of adherence to the management and the control of collapse zones. Again, the various types of collapses, we can have an outward collapse, we can have an outward 90-degree collapse, we can have a inward-outward collapse, you could have a cantilever collapse, and certainly you could have what's called a curtain fall collapse. again, the referencing back to some of the reports that we've given provide you some insights relative to those particular items. We've written quite extensively online relative to some items on collapse. If you go to both our Buildings on Fire page, our Fire Ground Leadership page, which I don't believe is still active. It's going to be undergoing some modifications and rebranding here shortly, but there are some variations and some issues dealing with collapse considerations, and we're actually getting to the point where we're running out of some time here, so I don't want to get into the details here on them regarding these types. So we've made some quick referencing to the types of collapses. There is a significant degree of some additional insights here, both in terms of collapse. We can have both structural collapse and compromise that can occur both internal within the building as well as external and commonly around the perimeter walls, and it's certainly affecting a very wide venue on the fire ground. The degree of collapse can certainly be very isolated or catastrophic in scope and in severity, can affect both building components, assemblies, or the entire system, such as a perimeter wall, roof, architectural or construction features. And again, it's inclusive of a canopy, a roof, coping, a parapet, or other features of that building. So there's both internal and external. One of the most common adverse effects that we're seeing is the adverse trends that are occurring dealing with perimeter wall collapses. We're seeing that time and time again in many reports, but we're also seeing a lot of near misses regarding structural features of that building, which are causing injuries, sometimes very catastrophic injuries, but may not have led to a line of duty death, but nonetheless may sometimes result in a very catastrophic, debilitating, life-altering injury that may affect the ability for that firefighter to return back to duty in a full-time capacity. So we've given some insights here in a very broad spectrum here with predictability. Again, I want to thank Bud for dropping in and talking a little bit with us here on this episode. And again, we're going to pick up on this conversation on our next installment, which will be on our part four of our series, which will conclude on October 21st at 7:30 here on Fire Engineering, blogtalkradio.com. So, again, until next time, companies are in quarters and off the air. Stay safe, but keep in mind there's a job being worked somewhere in the streets in your city, across the country, and around the world doing what we do best and being who we are, and that's firefighters. So take care, everyone. Thank you very much for listening in on Fire Engineering, Blog Talk Radio, on our Type 3 Insights, Brick and Joist Construction. And I'm your host, Christopher Naum. Until next time, stay safe, and thank you so very much for listening in.